Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for tuning in to the conversation, Hawaii Talks. The early motto of the Pony Express mentions how the mail must be delivered through snow and rain and heat and gloom of night. We hear from the U.S. Postal Service as it celebrates its 250-year anniversary. We step into the world of high-pressure food preservation at Hawaii's first summit on the topic. And did you know that the Iwa have the largest wings for their body weight of any bird in the world? We learn more in today's Manu Minute. Plus, we revisit our conversation about the consequences of media blackouts. How do they affect journalists and the citizens who rely on the information they provide? You are tuned to the conversation here on HPR One. I'm Catherine Cruz. The U.S. Postal Service turns 250 years old this weekend, and today it is releasing new stamps to mark the milestone. We talked to John Hyatt, a spokesman for the Postal Service, about the rich history of the vital service of mail delivery from the early days of the Pony Express to modern delivery in some communities via jet planes and electric vehicles. Here's Hyatt.
It's a really great honor to be celebrating this and to be serving the American public. It's really quite a great accomplishment, and we're in every community, and our employees are just a big part of wherever we are, the Postal Service is there.
Yeah, so tell us how the Postal Service is going to be marking this event.
We are going to be releasing a special pane of stamps called the 250 Years of Delivering Stamps. There's 20 stamps there. Each stamp depicts an individual scene of a letter carrier in the community, and when you put them all together, it's a really cool collage of a little city center town with carriers delivering to houses and businesses and people going into the post office and collection boxes and our new next generation delivery vehicles. And it's just a really great thing. So that's being officially released. They'll be available in local post offices and also online at our postal store as of the 23rd. And then we're also releasing a really special booklet called the Putting the Stamp on American Experience. It's a really cool booklet that shows a bunch of different stamps throughout the history of the Postal Service. And that's really exciting. And included in that booklet is a special re-release of the Benjamin Franklin 5-cent stamp that came out all in 1847 of the first Postmaster General, Benjamin Franklin. And that's been recreated as a forever stamp. And that's available as part of that booklet as well. And that booklet is online or available online at our postal store as well.
Most people think of Benjamin Franklin and his inventions. But yeah, the fact that he was our first Postmaster General is a big deal.
Yes, it is. The Second Continental Congress appointed him as the first Postmaster General to get the whole organization started in 1775. And it's been going across the country ever since. And like I said, it's in every neighborhood, and we deliver to more than 169 million addresses across the United States.
What should we know about our mail carriers who just toil out there every single day?
It's more than just letter carriers as well. We have a great retail team that accepts your packages and processes them locally in the post offices to help them get ready for delivery by the carriers. We have our mail handler clerks and our transportation who are processing them on machines and getting them from point A to point B. So it's a really involved process, and there's a lot involved. But once it gets to your neighborhood in Hawaii, our letter carriers are out there ready to deliver safely to you and to get those sometimes up to 7 days a week, or Monday through Saturday. And then there's some areas that have Sunday deliveries as well.
Yes, I often see our mail carrier in our neighborhood on Sundays with all those boxes. And we know they work extra hard around the holidays, but gosh, since the pandemic, the volume of material, I'm sure, has increased tremendously.
Yes, absolutely. Since pandemic, when a lot of people were ordering necessary items, a lot of them came through the mail, and our carriers and employees really did a lot to come to work every day during that time and make sure that our customers in Hawaii were being able to get their much needed goods. And since then, the volume has continued to go with packages. And we're just really excited that here we are from 250 years of delivering mail and packages, and we're still able to provide it to the local communities in Hawaii.
It's really neat. On my street, I have a neighbor who's a monk seal guy, and one of his photos was featured on the marine science stamps recently. And so it's really fun to know that there's that connection there.
Yeah, absolutely. Another really cool connection about Hawaii Postal Services. So the first mention of postal services in Hawaii was all the way back to 1846. And the first dedicated post office building was built in Honolulu in 1850. And I just found that very interesting as I was looking up some information. And then the Hawaii Postal Service became part of the U.S. Postal Service in 1900. The Postal Service has been really a big part of Hawaii and making sure people get vital communication and necessary packages. And we're really thrilled to be a part of the Hawaii community.
So the next time you see your mail carrier, you might want to wish them happy anniversary.
That would be wonderful. I'm sure they would love to celebrate with you the 250 years. And many of our carriers have been a long time part of that. We've got carriers that work for 40, 50, 60 years as part of the community. And it's just really amazing their dedication and love for their customers. So they see children grow up and big events and big part of the community. We're really thrilled to be a part of that as we celebrate this anniversary. Just as a close out for folks, just a reminder that we have a very special website for the 250th anniversary, which is going to include a lot of our history, facts, and more information about serving the community for 250 years. And it's at usps.com/250. And there's going to be a lot of cool information there.
That was John Hyatt, spokesman for the U.S. Postal System, which was created in 1775. Look for links to find out about those celebratory stamps that were released today as the post office marks 250 years of delivering our mail.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. Boosting Hawaii's food exports and decreasing our reliance on imports is part of the goal of the Wahewa Value-Added Product Development Center. HPR first visited the center in October, months after it opened its doors. Well, the center held Hawaii's first ever high-pressure processing summit last week, a day packed with speakers and seminars. It was meant to drum up interest in the center's state-of-the-art hyperbaric chamber. The hyperbaric machine is a way to extend the shelf life of food products. It has yet to be used commercially. Instead, facility managers say that it is sized for research and development. The machine whirled into action to perform demonstrations in real time during the summit. Haley Joe is the product development manager at the center. She spoke with HPR's Mark Ladau about the vision for the hyperbaric technology and the foods that she's most excited to preserve with high-pressure processing.
The intent of this summit really comes from being the center that houses the first HPP machine and the introduction of HPP technology to the state of Hawaii. We have a lot to learn, to educate the public with, and to support our entrepreneurs in utilizing this technology. And we thought that over the past year of doing multiple workshops a year, we did quarterly workshops with Hyperbaric free for the public to introduce this technology to the public. And we had commissioned our machine, got it permitted with the Department of Health. And we thought this is the perfect time to gather everyone in person, run the machine, run entrepreneurs' real life samples that they are selling at a given shelf life, run through the machine so that they can see, touch, feel, taste, and be excited to jump into the next step to use our machine and work with our center further.
Can you talk a little bit about what makes this high pressure processing better or like a viable alternative for folks who don't want to do the other kinds of preserving?
That's a great question. So hyperbaric is the manufacturer of our machine, and high pressure processing is a technology. It can be confusing when we hear about shelf life extension and to interpret it as the one solution for all kinds of product. That is not the case, and that's why we're here to educate what is compatibility for the product, what is compatibility for packaging types, and so that folks can have the right understanding to then decide and pursue if HPP is the right avenue that they want to pursue. And other traditional preservation methods most commonly is heat and what we refer to as pasteurization or canning, and those all exist and folks are using that currently, like your local hot sauces, like your jams and jellies, that can achieve shelf stability where HPP cannot. However, the HPP real advantage and why it's so important that we are excited to have for Hawaii is that it bypasses heat, where so many of our special crops, our amazing produce and fruits will have quality degradation by heat. And so we are able to preserve the freshness, all the flavor, while expanding the possibility of distribution and market access without compromising any of the quality.
Is there a specific kind of food that you kind of had in mind?
The one product I am personally most excited about for all kinds of reasons is poi and other Hawaiian foods, cultural foods that we tend to make fresh and have within our family or go out to restaurants, but you know, don't last more than a few days and we have to start another pot. And poi is so special because we have this tradition of letting it sour, and everybody prefers a different kind of sourness. And poi has the perfect parameters and metrics for HPP processing. It is just wet enough and just acidic enough. So it's perfect condition prime for HPP and to extend the most shelf life. With HPP, poi is able to consistently stay at that sourness and delay spoilage for much longer. So for example, your local grocery store sells poi up to, they stock it on the shelf up to 3-5 days and up to when it becomes too sour and too bubbly to sell. And that's the end of shelf life. And I learned that Taro Brands produces poi every week fresh and then goes straight to the stores. And with HPP, poi can be made, you know, at least 3 months ahead of time and be distributed. And so that we don't have to rely on poi to be sold out that day of, and we can actually have it sit steady, sit comfortably on the shelf for a long time. So that's what I'm most excited about product-wise, but in general, I'm excited about our small farmers being able to aggregate their produce, such as mango, such as lily koi, such as, you know, dragon fruit, to be able to process into purees that then, you know, the jams and jelly makers, the cookies, the smoothies, you know, food brand entrepreneurs that can then use. Because what we do lack here is a lot of middle processing, post-harvest processing, because it does take a lot of labor for an entrepreneur that has a juice brand or a CMOS brand to then peel every single mango to then juice it, puree it. So what's really helpful is for HPP to unlock that post-harvest puree processing. And now this puree can last much longer and does not need to take up freezer space. This freezer space is much harder to find than refrigeration. So that's also what I'm excited about. And just going back to poi, we can have possibilities for luaus in the pouch, right? Kalua pig in a pouch, you know, all kinds of culinary traditions that we can then share with the world.
And Michael Richards showed up to the summit. He was excited about the potential to use the technology for his business. He runs Mauka Meats and says that shelf life stability is critical for the suppliers and distributors that want to stock his products.
We are a local meat retail and distribution company that only works with local meat. So everything that we source is from Hawaii ranchers, Hawaii farmers, and also Hawaii hunters. Our specialties are Hawaii pasture-raised rose veal, Hawaiian wild venison, everything taken and done underneath USDA inspection, as well as local beef, local pork, and local lamb.
Can I ask your interest in the summit and what it can do for you as a business and sort of with your product?
We do whole animal, everything. It's the best way to support local ranchers and local USDA processors by being able to clear everything on the animal. You can't just pick only the steaks. It doesn't work like that. A cow is not made out of only ribeyes. So what we did is with every animal we made, besides just the regular cuts, grind, hamburger, and things like that, we make all kinds of products, sausages, and especially for sausages, cured meats, but especially one of the biggest things is stock and bone broth is what a lot of people know it as. So we are especially interested over here at the HPP Summit in how we can extend the shelf life of a lot of our products, because what we try and do is make clean label items, things that don't have a lot of preservatives inside there, or we're trying to not use phosphate, diacetate, a lot of, you know, when you look at the ingredient label and see something that has 12 syllables on it that you have to look up on Wikipedia, we're trying to make food, food again. And basically, the high pressure processing seems to be kind of one of those options that we can use to make the food that we want, but have the shelf life and the stability needed so that we can actually get it into a grocery store or we can get it into a distributor. So our stock, we only use filtered water and bones. We cook it 24 hours and we don't put any salt or any additives inside there. But our shelf life is only 7 days. If it's just purely refrigerated, it only lasts 7 days. So that's why we're, especially the HPP, our stock has a 7 day shelf life. But when we ran it through the HPP machine, it actually extended it out to 6 months when stored in just everyday refrigeration. And that is a huge thing, because now, you know, if things need to sit for a little bit longer, it's not gonna get anybody sick. That's the biggest thing for food safety, but also now it's easier for a distributor to be able to plan and move things around. A grocery store can have a product that sits there for 30 days and be absolutely sure that it's gonna be safe for people to eat. Especially if you've got an extra 6 months and everything. Like, if it's not clearing out, then I've got another problem and everything. I need to make my product to taste better. But that's our biggest thing. The HPP is a big, huge game changer in shelf life extension and just creating supply chain resiliency.
Yeah, game changer indeed. We've been hearing from people who attended the high pressure processing summit that took place last Thursday, and we're told that interested groups can begin testing out the hyperbaric chamber at the Waihewa Value Added Product Development Center next month. You know, it is time now for everyone's favorite Manu Minute. We are introducing you this morning to a bird that is often seen but not heard. The great frigate bird, or Eva, flies high above our heads, performing acrobatic feats midair. We've got the song of this storied seabird today, thanks to the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo's Patrick Hart.
One of the most distinctive birds in the skies above Hawaii is the Eva, or great frigate bird. Dark black and a bit ominous looking, they have a distinctive bent wing silhouette when in flight, with long pointed wings, a long hooked bill, and a deeply forked tail. Eva are found in oceans throughout the tropics, and while they're often seen on all the main Hawaiian islands, they nest primarily in shrubs and small trees in the northwest Hawaiian islands. Eva are incredibly agile flyers, and they use this maneuverability to harass other seabirds in flight and force them to drop their food, which they'll often grab in mid-air. The biological term for this pirate-like behavior is kleptoparasitism, and this has led to their Hawaiian name of Eva, which means thief. Though they actually do catch the majority of their food themselves by skimming the ocean surface for fish and squid. Eva have the largest wings for their body weight of any bird in the world, and recent studies using satellite transmitters have shown that they can fly over 2 months without landing. While they're incredible flyers, they lack the ability to take off from water, and they're also very clumsy on land. Eva are one of those birds that are much more often seen than heard. The best place to hear their vocalizations are on their breeding grounds, where the males attempt to attract females by blowing up a brilliant orange balloon-like pouch below their bills and uttering a hoarse cackle when the female comes near. Unlike many other native bird species in Hawaii, the Eva seem to be doing well, with a population size estimated at 60,000 birds or more. Eva have a lifespan of about 35 years, And like many seabirds, wait a long time before they first breed. In their case, 9 years or older. Eva are featured prominently in Hawaiian culture, and their glossy black feathers were used in the kahili of royalty and in feathered capes. One well-known Olelo Noeau proclaims, Lele ka Eva malie kai ko'o, meaning, when the Eva bird flies out to sea, the rough sea will be calm. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
You know, we're revisiting a story that we first brought you in February. It was about the role of transparency in democracy. Shortly after President Donald Trump took office for his second term, his administration began putting restrictions on how federal agencies could communicate with the outside world. Employees within the Department of Health and Human Services, as well as the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, were told to suspend much of their communication with scientific partners and the media. So what do these blackouts mean for journalists and listeners? Fernanda Camarena is a faculty member at the Poynter Institute. She co-authored a report about a media gag orders titled Shut Out Strategies for Good Journalism When Sources Dismiss the Press. The Conversation's D.W. Gibson spoke with her about the consequences of these media blackouts.
The truth is, it has always been hard to get information from those in power. That's why we have investigative reporting. News organizations file FOIAs, Freedom of Information Acts. They also take agencies to court and go into records. And so whether it's a government department or the White House, there has always been some level of reluctancy from newsmakers to be held accountable. Now, some officials within these agencies in our current government speaking anonymously out of fear of retaliation, have told several media organizations that Trump's directive goes far beyond past restrictions. They describe it as a sort of direct effort to silence health experts rather than just a messaging purpose. I do think that there's going to be a big ripple effect in the ways that we do our journalism and how we held people in power accountable.
Well, at the Poynter Institute, I know you and your colleagues have been collecting examples and contemplating strategies to stem the erosion of access that you're talking about that undermines the value of independent reporting and that in turn helps citizens participate robustly in their civic life. Give us some sense of examples that have caught your attention.
These challenges aren't new, but they are getting worse. Newsrooms are relying on more anonymous sources. And other ways journalists are adapting to this trend, frankly, is partnering with legal teams, leaning into data journalism, for example, or building networks of whistleblowers to counteract when lawmakers deny them access. When officials shut out the press, they are really shutting out the public. And when journalists make it clear why they're being blocked, it shifts the conversation from a media issue to a democracy issue.
I think that's what matters to our listeners, frankly. You know, agencies going dark affects the information that each voter, each taxpayer gets. So talk a little bit more about how this relates to the idea that journalists should let go of the fear that they don't want to become this story, as you wrote.
We're living in a moment that the whole no comment, as we see in a lot of news reports, we reached out to this person and received no comment, and you continue with your narrative or with your story. We need to change that. That is a disservice to the audience. We need to add context onto why is it that they're not speaking. And not only the why, but the how and what is the ripple effect in people's lives without that information. I think if we don't have that context around the lack of availability or the lack of access or the no comment, we're not really telling the full story. And sometimes us as journalists, we always say, you know, we don't want to be part of the story, but it is not about us. It is about the audience, and it is about the information that is being denied. And if we focus on that, it's about the people's right to be well informed.
Yeah, such a great point. And you have a great example in the report about the University of Florida, the school newspaper there, dealing with a no-comment situation. Could you tell us a little bit about that? Because I think it's really illustrative.
So the editor of this newspaper at the University of Florida, he and his team were facing this reluctance of the incoming president not being available to just sit down with the students' newspaper. They once, twice, three times tried to reach out to the president, and you know, the president wasn't available for any type of interview or scrutiny. And so the students saw an opportunity to make public this issue that they were facing. They released an editorial really showcasing their ongoing efforts. And I love not only the fact that they released a specific editorial to inform the public of what was going on and to inform the students, but the way that the language and their style was very much in tone of them as a university. And they mentioned something like, paging Ben Sasse, are you there? They even posted flyers throughout the campus to see if he responded. So, you know, I think there's a lot of things that we can learn from the student community, because it shows that you're working for the audience, you're working for the people, and the people need to know all of your efforts. And the way to do so is to really meet them where they are, is to show them in the language that you share with your audience, the style, and to be candid about your efforts.
That phrase, no comment, I think falls so flat for so many readers. It's such a rote statement at this point. It just sort of listeners brush right past it, I think. And this example at the University of Florida, you're speaking to the sort of conversational tone they took in the editorial, posting bills and notices around campus that people can physically see, and sticking to very specific information. We called this amount of times. I think all of this is engagement in trying to get people that are a part of that community to care about the lack of information.
Correct. If you're not transparent with your audience about moments that you are blocked or issues that you encounter throughout your reporting, they don't see themselves, or they don't see the full picture reflected in your story, it diminishes your credibility. You start losing audience, you start losing the trust in your community, and that is really, really, really hard to come back. It's the, I would say, the most detrimental thing that a journalist can face.
That was Fernanda Camarena of the Poynter Institute talking with HPR's D.W. Gibson. We will be back with the second half of that really interesting conversation after a break. Yes, and let's get back to that conversation with Fernanda Camarena of the Poynter Institute. Back in February, she spoke with D.W. Gibson about the wide-ranging effects of media blackouts.
You know, one thing you wrote about is the importance of journalists partnering rather than competing to cover more ground. Can you talk more about what that looks like in practical terms?
A lot of the times we think of our competitors as people or agencies that are trying to beat us or are competing for something. And I think what's beautiful with journalism in times of struggle and in times of transformation is that we all serve the same goal. We all function under the same principles. And based on those guiding journalistic principles, we have a beautiful common ground to make sure that our common goal is fulfilled. It doesn't matter if it's by one journalist, by two journalists, or by five journalists working together. And so part of the reason why collaborating is very important is because you take what each journalist or each news org has to offer, and you build a great, effective, strong mosaic of the best way to move forward. So collaborating rather not competing can give you a way of saying, well, I can't afford legal fees, and therefore I'm going to collaborate with a news organization that does have that resource.
The report says that political polarization, repeated vitriol from those who would demonize the media, and a breakdown of relationships between journalists and the people they cover have made the problem more severe. Those sound like big issues. How does such a ship get righted? Or is that a sort of old-fashioned way of thinking about things? Is there a new way we should be thinking about the media landscape we find ourselves in?
We have to meet our audience where they're at. If you don't have an audience that is proactively going into your website and really searching for those answers and basically taking that initiative, it is our responsibility, the same effort we put in reporting, being accurate, transparent, and fair. It is as important to also meet them and to also seek their opinion and show them what we have without necessarily expecting them to come to us. So we're seeing a lot of efforts on how to partner up with media influencers or how to be a little bit more effective on social media. We've seen some mainstream news organizations decide to really go into the digital space, into the social space, and say, you know, we don't really have a lot of people tuning in 6 to 7 for their prime time newscast. And so if we really want to serve our audience, we need to meet them where they are. I just also want to mention something on news consumption. When reporters can't talk to government sources daily, it limits the range of viewpoints the public gets, right? So instead of hearing from a variety of perspectives, we often only hear through the government side, through official sites, which is the press releases or just official information out there. And information doesn't equal truth. The fact that reporters are only getting press releases doesn't mean that that's truth. That's information. And it's our job to verify, and it's our job to provide context. With fewer traditional outlets having access to government officials, people are turning into social media for breaking news. And so social media, as we know, can be a double-edged sword. Information often gets distorted and gets distorted faster. So it can also create public confusion. The public can end up with a fragmented view of what's happening. This uncertainty can really spread confusion and make people even more skeptical about the media and the government.
The point you make reminds me of a guest we had on the show recently, a nonprofit leader, who was speaking to the fact that we value information, we value facts, the information that leads to facts. But we also can't forget that people have feelings, that people are having emotional reactions to the world they find themselves in right now. And I think that that's sort of the balancing act right now, meeting people where they're at, meeting readers and listeners where they're at, and at the same time, striving to make sure you're also not only speaking to that emotion, but sticking to facts. That's the balance.
Correct. And we have to also make sure that we are, in a way, rebranding our facts. And I know that sounds a little odd, but the same way that we personalize our stories and have that deep connection that you mentioned, a connection that resonates with people's day-to-day lives, and people see themselves reflected on the information that we provide because we personalize that information with things that they can touch, they can hear, they can feel. Well, the same way we need to look at facts that way. I know there's this idea that, you know, when presenting facts and or data or things that we know and we've researched and we verified, just to put it out there and say, well, that's a false statement and just leave it that like that. I know it's not the best way to for people to relate and to understand and to really see how it affects their lives. I've seen time and time again in social media, a single post from a specific news org just saying, well, that was a false comment. And just to leave it like that, I think we can do a better job. I think there's instances that, you know, we need to call out what's false. But I also think that there's a great opportunity to call out truths.
That was Fernanda Camarena of the Poynter Institute. She was talking with HPR's D.W. Gibson. They were discussing the Trump administration's restrictions on media access to public officials and how it affects journalists and the public in our democracy. Well, that is it for our show today. Tomorrow, we hear from members of the Protect Kaho'olawe Ohana as the group nears 50 years of Aloha Aina.